And I thought, you know, this is stuff that English speakers, people who can't read Japanese, should know about. And I want to get this out there so that a new audience can take a look at it with their own eyes and come to their own conclusions and give their own input on these things. I wanted to contribute something. So if I was able to do that, then I'm very happy.
Ladies and gentlemen,
this is one of the weirder stories from Japan, right, for sure. Jimenken is basically means in Japanese the human-faced dog. The mysterious suicide forest is, the real name of it is Aokigahara, which means the sea of trees. Yes, the Hibagon is a Japanese-owned, homegrown Bigfoot. Throughout Ainu folklore, they've had the story of the Akoro Kamui, which is basically a huge, massive, red, almost octopus-like creature. There's just enough weirdness to kind of link them together in a way that just makes people scratch their heads, you know? Like, I want to know what went on over there.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 9. Very excited about this installment of the program for a number of reasons, really. First of all, I've always been fascinated by Japan. It's been one of those places, it's like my bucket list of places I'd like to visit, that and the pyramids. And I've always wanted to do a show about Japan and Japanese myths and legends on BOA Audio, but I've noticed over the years that it's just increasingly difficult to find somebody that knows these myths and legends and speaks English that we can get on the program to talk about it. And then a few years back, I discovered the work of one Brent Swanser, who writes right now for Mysterious Universe. He started out over at Cryptomundo, and then he moved over to Mysterious Universe. And there he has a huge array of articles that he's written over the years about Japanese folklore, Japanese myths and legends, Japanese oddities and strange things, and then over the years branched out into just strange and mysterious stories of that nature around the world, and has found some amazing stories. And the work of Brent Swanser is some of the most unsung, outstanding reporting going on the paranormal out there right now on the internet. And I know that covers a large array of people who are writing about the paranormal, but his stuff is so consistently good that anytime I see an article from him cross my eyes on my newsfeed, I'm like, oh, let's look at this one. This one's going to be good. It's always good. It's always fascinating. It's amazingly well written. And it's more often than not, almost always, some story that I've never heard before and either leaves me with chills or just leaves me absolutely amazingly educated about something strange and unusual that I hadn't heard about. And he's the complete opposite of your typical person in the world of the paranormal, because this is his first interview ever, and I've been really on his case over the last year or so to get him on BOA Audio. I've been chasing him down hardcore. We're talking like Bruce Rucks level here, folks. I finally found his email after a few years of trying to figure out how to find him, and then subsequently have been kind of wearing him down until he agreed to come on the program. And I'm absolutely thrilled to have him here on the show, so I'm really looking forward to finally getting to know him and get him here on the program and really introduce him to hopefully a much wider audience. So welcome to BOA Audio, Brent. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very, very happy to be here. I've been looking forward to it.
So have I, man. So have I. Like I said, I've been a huge fan of your stuff for years and years and years. Really, I really enjoyed your stuff for such a long time. And, I'm
thank
amazed
you, you.
that you haven't done any shows yet. So I'm really psyched that we could be the first folks to get you.
Yeah,
out
this
there
is my first one. My first one. I haven't done anything so far. You know, I've been invited on a couple of shows over the years, and I wasn't sure. You know, I wasn't sure. I was a little nervous, but you know, everything I hear about your show is great, and I thought, let's do this. I want to do it.
Nice.
So I'm very happy to be here. Yes.
Awesome. Awesome. It may come as, I don't know if it would come as a surprise to folks or not, because you sound very American, but you're in Japan right now. So you're our first ever guest.
I'm in Japan.
In Japan. Yes. Yeah. We finally broke it into the Pacific, on this show after 9 seasons. Like I said, it's really hard to find somebody, who can do a show like this. So tell us a little bit about Brent Swanser, you know, give us the bio background. How did you end up writing about all this stuff, and, you know, how did you end up in Japan and everything?
Well, I came to Japan about, I came here in February of 1996, so about 19 years.
Wow.
And, yeah, it's been a long time, and it wasn't really, that wasn't really the plan at first. You know, I came over here for 1 year. I was going to study Japanese, and I was going to study about, you know, some of the things in Japan. I was really interested. And it just turned into 2 years and 3 years and 4 years, and I kind of got caught up here, and I fell in love with this country. I mean, I love this place. And here I am, 19 years later. And a few years ago, maybe 8 years ago, I started writing on Cryptomundo, and I'd always had an interest in cryptozoology and various Fortiana. And my main thing was cryptozoology, and I found this site Cryptomundo, and I started, you know, commenting on it. And, you know, my comments were usually pretty lengthy. I mean, these were articles unto themselves, pretty much. And I guess it caught the attention of Lauren Coleman, who at the time, you know, he's pretty famous in cryptozoological circles. He read one of my articles, and he sent me a personal email. I was really surprised, like, Lauren Coleman, wow. I mean, I was a big fan.
Yeah.
I'd read all his books. And he sent me an email saying, I really enjoyed your article. I mean, your comment. And he said, you know, that this is good stuff, you know. And tell me a little bit about yourself. So I started, you know, mailing back and forth with Lauren Coleman, and I was pretty stoked because I was a big fan. And then one day he asked me, you know, why don't you write a guest blog about one of your topics, you know. And I think it was, if I remember correctly, it was about Japanese wolves in Japan that were extinct, but people think they're still out there. And I wrote an article about that, and he really liked it. So then that started to become a regular thing, and I was just writing guest blogs for Cryptomundo. And that's pretty much how it all took off.
Nice, nice.
As far as the writing goes. Yeah, and I was really happy to be on there, and happy to talk to Lauren Coleman. And that's what I've been doing ever since. And now I've moved over to Mysterious Universe, which is a great site. And I like it there. And I've branched out into other things. Like you said, you know, I started off mostly in cryptozoology. But I have an interest in lots of other stuff. So this has given me a platform to kind of write about other things that I was interested in that I never really wrote about on Cryptomundo. So it's been a very good experience so far. Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, man, I can't put it over enough. And I really, really do enjoy your stuff. It's really tremendous.
Thank you very much. You know, I was really honored that you came to me with that, because you know, I didn't really have a personal policy, like I won't do interviews or anything like that. I wasn't being a recluse or anything. But
you're not a diva.
Right. So nobody ever really invited me on their shows. I mean, a couple times, and I wasn't really sure, you know. And then you came to me, and you were telling me how good my stuff was, and I should get on the show. And I thought, I'll do it. Yeah.
All right.
I'm happy to be here. I'm happy that you're my first show to be on.
I'm thrilled, man. I'm thrilled, because you deserve all the kudos in the world. So that's the bio background. Now, we went sort of, I don't know if it's old school or new school BOA audio style here, but I went through, this is how tremendous Brent's stuff is, folks. I went through the vast archive of his work at Mysterious Universe and parsed it down to like 20 stories out of like 14 pages of an archive and narrowed it down to 20. And then even then it was like, that's too many. So I had to narrow that down to about a dozen. So, we cherry-picked what I think were the most intriguing stories to me here from the archive. But this is really the very tip of an amazing iceberg, folks. So tonight we're going to get into, about a dozen or so of some of the big stories that Brent has written over the years. And hopefully this is the beginning of future correspondences on the program where we can cover some more of these stories because there's so many good ones on your archive.
I hope so. Thank you.
And we'll start out with... one that you specifically sort of mentioned is one of your personal favorites, which is nice because
yes.
It's good to start out with, you know, the one that's kind of like probably your touchstone story here, and that's the cursed paradise of now forgive me, it's Palmyra Atoll, I think, but maybe not.
Palmyra Atoll, yes, that's right.
So tell me about this.
Palmyra, people say Palmyra.
All right. Okay, I'll try either way as we go.
I think both are fine.
There you go. So tell me about this this story here of the cursed paradise of Palmyra Atoll.
I've always had an interest, and if you read through my stuff, there's quite a lot of articles on islands. And I've always been interested in islands and the things that go on there. And I think there's kind of a... Well, I think somewhere in the human psyche, there's kind of a... almost an archetype of the magical, mysterious island out there, you know, somewhere out in the ocean that nobody knows about, where all these weird things go on.
Like Lost.
And like Lost. And I think that appeals to people. I think they have, you know, they have this image of this place far from civilization where these things go on. And it's almost like a, like stuck in the human psyche. And I've always been drawn to that. I think a lot of people are drawn to that. Mm. And I knew about this island, this strange island, Palmyra Atoll. It's actually an atoll, not really an island, but like a grouping of little islands all together.
Yeah.
And I had heard about this place before, and I was really interested in writing about that. I thought that might, you know, really appeal to people. And it's quite a weird... you know, exactly like Lost. I mean, it almost seems like Lost was based on this island, really. And that's what really inspired me to write about it.
Well, what's been said that happens at this island that's so... Well, it's a cursed paradise, so what's the curse aspect of it?
The curse is, okay, it's this is an atoll that's out in the Pacific Ocean. And it's pretty much uninhabited. There's no permanent inhabitants right now. And it's always had, you know, throughout history, all these weird stories. Like a lot of boats went missing there. They had stories about how boats would be, you know, going by there and these coral reefs would suddenly appear out of nowhere. People that landed on the island claimed that... there was all kinds of weird stuff going on, like lights in the sky, and you know, the sharks were apparently really, really aggressive there, more than usual.
Yeah.
And people kind of avoided it. Really, it was. It's been like that for quite a while since, you know, like the early 1700s. People have been kind of avoiding that island because it had such a bad mojo to it.
Yeah.
You know? So. Yeah, there were lots of stories like this, and for a while it was kind of almost like a spooky ghost story that sailors told themselves about.
Yeah,
out in Palmyra Atoll. So it started out kind of with since it was discovered, it was kind of considered to be cursed by a lot of sailors that went through there. That's where I think it all started. You know, some of these sailors that crashed on the reefs, you know, they would get to the shore and they would kind of, you know, be waiting for help. And they would tell kind of stories about how there was things in the forest and how the stuff in the sea that was usually okay to eat would be poisonous. They were like, well, why is this poisonous? You know, they would eat these things that normally would be okay to eat and people would die. And it was kind of weird. And they saw these kind of like shadowy figures running around in the forest. They weren't quite sure what that was. So it was, and this is way back, you know, in the 1700s that this was already starting.
Weird.
So, it's pretty weird. And a lot of people, said that, you know, when they get there, they were just overcome with this sense of, terror, really. I mean, they just knew that there was something off. I mean, something, they couldn't quite put their finger on it, but, you know, they've been on, some of them had been on quite a few islands, and something about this place, it was just touched something that really freaked people out.
Weird.
I mean, they just wanted to get off of there, and they didn't really know why at first in some cases. They just wanted to get off of there. It just has this kind of atmosphere of evil, really.
Weird.
It's pretty weird.
Do people, venture there nowadays?
There have been, even in modern times, there have been people who have gone through there. And a lot of them, you know, they say the same kind of thing. It's a threatening place. It's very hostile. There's all kinds of weird things going on there, like compasses don't quite work right, or they see lights in the sky. They just say that almost everybody who goes there, I mean, even in modern days, you know, there's yachts that go by and stop by. Everybody says that there's just something off about that, and they just feel kind of threatened for some reason. And I guess it's just got... It's kind of a weird vibe, and it's not, it wouldn't be the first time in modern times that something weird has happened there. I mean, during World War II, the U.S. Navy used it as a facility, and they kind of used it for refueling station and for long-range air patrols that were going there. And I believe that submarines also used it as kind of a refueling station. And a lot of the soldiers there, you know, kind of, they wanted to get off. They were asking to get transferred. It got only even worse when there were some planes that took off from there that had some weird things that happened. There was one plane that went and it flew off and it was nice weather. It just suddenly kind of, they had some kind of difficulty, and nobody knew what was going on, and this thing just kind of went down on the other side of the island, and they sent out a search patrol. They figured it went down, and they went looking for it, and they never found anything. They never found any wreckage. They never found even a screw from that plane, and it's kind of weird. I mean, everybody thought they saw it go down.
Yeah, weird.
But they don't know what happened to it. It just kind of disappeared. And you know, this was back during World War II, and there was another one that another plane that took off. It was supposed to go north. It started flying south, and it had an experienced crew, and there were no problems with the plane when it took off, and ignored all attempts to signal it, and it just kind of went down. And nobody knew what was going on. Again, they couldn't find the wreckage. It's just kind of weird, you know. And even the Navy officers there were saying that it was there was a lot of bad luck there. I mean, a lot of the men got into fights. They got irritable. Yeah, and there was some kind of force or who knows what it was. But it wasn't normal day-to-day operations of a naval base. That's for sure.
Strange. Now, this makes me wonder, this isn't anywhere, I don't think you've written this at all, but you're officially now our man on the ground in Japan, so you would have the insight on this. So, you know, here, of course, this, aside from the pockets of people who study the case, let's say, I guess people, the mainstream folks just assume Amelia Earhart disappeared, but then there's the theory that she was, like, captured by the Japanese. I guess the question is, like, what do people think and say over in Japan with regards to that whole story?
Oh, in Japan with Amelia Earhart.
Right, right.
With Amelia Earhart in Japan, it's not really, you know, I'm not sure why, but it's never really been particularly a big story over here. I mean, there's talk about it, but it's never been a particularly popular or as big as it is over in the States. You know, in the States, Amelia Earhart is like synonymous with people who have disappeared.
Right. Yeah.
Over the ocean, and in Japan, it's you know, it has never really been deeply touched on, really. As far as the stories about being captured by the Japanese or things like that, they've always kind of never really been drawn to that theory. They kind of deny that.
Right, right. Well, it'd be kind of like, it's sort of like Americans and Native Americans, you know, it's like people don't, we don't want to talk about that sort of, that kind of, I think it's kind of that right. vibe where it's like, let's not bring up the whole fact that we captured Amelia Earhart, you know.
That, right, right. They probably want to draw attention away from that. But,
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that's never been a popular theory over here. It's interesting how wherever you go, you know, they have a different theory that's kind of catered to their own preferences.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, as far as Japan goes, they haven't really ever warmed up to that idea. As far as Amelia Earhart goes,
I can see. So, I can imagine. Yeah. Is there more from Palmyra Atoll we should talk about?
Oh, well, yeah. There was actually one of the most famous things. You were asking me about the modern-day occurrences about Palmyra Island. It has one of the most famous unsolved murders happened there.
Mm.
And this happened in 1974. And it was a couple. One was Malcolm Graham. Everybody called him Mac. And then there was Eleanor Graham, who is his wife. Everybody called him Muff, so it was Mac and Muff. And they had this, you know, this really romantic idea to go out on their boat and sail around the world. And, you know, at first his wife wasn't too sure about it, but, you know, she kind of went along with it. And, you know, they left from Hawaii. They were well-stocked, and they went out there. And, you know, when they got out there, there were already some people there, like not a permanent settlement, but, you know, hippies, basically. And, you know, they were kind of camped out on the island. And it was Buck Walker and Stephanie Stearns were two of the main ones in this case. And they had been living there for a while. They had been running from the law.
This is Palmyra Atoll. They're living in.
This is Palmyra Atoll, and they had trouble with the law, and they had kind of gone out there. They took all their life savings, took this rundown boat, and went out there. And when the Grahams went there, there they were. And there were a couple other people there, and they were a little disappointed because, you know, they wanted to get away from civilization and be out in the middle of the ocean. But they met, you know, these people. And a few people camped out there at the time. It was Buck and Stephanie Stearns, which are the people that were kind of running from the law. And Mac and Muff went there, and you know, they didn't really get along too well. And apparently, after a few months, there was no more contact from the Grahams. They just kind of dropped off the face of the earth. And then people were kind of concerned, and they sent people out there to look for them, and they couldn't find them, the Grahams, or their boat, which was called the Sea Wind. That was their boat that they had taken. Nobody could figure out what happened to them. They ended up finding Muff's body not long after, and it was kind of just in the bottom of this lagoon, stuck in this container. It had apparently been dislodged. It was found by this couple who was passing through from South Africa, and they'd just been walking along the beach, and this container kind of washed up on shore, and nobody had heard from the Grahams in a while. And they found the body just kind of stuffed in this container. There was no clue what happened to her husband. I mean, they still don't know really what happened to him. And, basically, it was just human bones there that were discovered to be those of Muff Graham, which was the wife, Eleanor. It just seemed really weird. Nobody really knew what happened. And the other people who had been there kind of just disappeared. And
yikes.
Yeah, and they figured that, you know, who killed her, you know? What happened here? Why was she stuck in this container? Like, where was everybody? You know, everybody had already left at the time. It was pretty weird, yeah. And they ended up finding... They ended up arresting Stephanie and Buck Walker, Stephanie Stearns and Buck Walker. They ended up charging them with murder, but they didn't really have anything to hold them with. They charged them with boat theft because they had ended up finding them with the boat that the Grahams had been riding, but they had no evidence to show that they had ever killed anybody.
Yeah.
So it was weird.
Highly yeah. circumstantial. Sounds like they did it, but you
it's
know.
Highly circumstantial. I mean, they didn't know who did it. You know, at the trial, all this stuff happened, and there was one guy who had been living there. You know, he was saying that he had been walking out on the beach after a storm, and on the beach he found this. Basically all this stuff, flotsam and things that had been washed up. And he found a cardboard mailing tube. And this is a guy who had lived on Palmyra Island at the time. And he just found it on the beach one day after a storm. And he opened it up and he found a detail chart of Palmyra Island, which was, kind of weird. It kind of goes beyond coincidence. I mean, it was synchronicity for sure.
Yeah, that's odd.
And he found this detail chart. You know, this is long after this happened. And like, why am I finding this? And it was almost like the island calling out, you know, as some people say. Pretty spooky, actually.
Strange.
And there were a bunch of spooky things, like apparently letters that the woman who had been killed, she had been sending to family and friends, said that she thought the island was evil and there were things going on here. And the friends who had been receiving the letters felt like kind of like she was saying goodbye.
Weird.
And this is before she was killed, something was going on. They never did find out who killed them, but it's just weird that this stuff, you know, happened out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, nobody knew what was going on. I mean, this is all found years after, you know, the body in the container, and then you got this weird mailing tube washing up on shore with maps of Palmyra Island that the guy who had been living there at the time found, and it was just kind of bizarre.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? They never found out what happened. There was a trial, and Buck Walker, who everybody thinks killed him because he never really got along with them, he went to prison for boat theft, and he was originally, you know, in prison for that. But they let them go on parole in 2007, I think it was. Hmm. And there were these stories that he had had an affair with the wife of, you know, with Muff Walker, who was who was killed. Muff, who was killed. They had all these kind of stories about how that happened, but nobody really knows what happened. It's kind of a mystery what happened on this weird island out in the middle of the Pacific, so... Yeah, that kind of drew me to the story.
Yeah.
And there have been other things, like in 1987, there was a boat that was found drifting around near the island, and they found that it was kind of like the Mary Celeste. It was kind of just abandoned. That happened just in 1987.
Oh, wow.
And, they found a couple abandoned things, and... 1970s, they found one that was floating around out there. They found a couple boats that were just kind of abandoned floating around the island, which is kind of weird, too. And that kind of adds to the whole mystique.
Yeah, yeah, it's strange.
Yeah.
Really weird. Part of me wants to go there, and then another part of me is like, don't ever go there.
Yeah. It's got a long history of weirdness.
Yeah, that's for sure. Seems like
yeah. There was one in 1989 that was kind of weird. This family, there was a guy called Graham Hughes, and he went aboard his boat with his family in 1989 from San Diego, and they visited Palmyra Island for a while. And that's where they were going to go. And then they were going to head out again to go sailing around, and they kind of just disappeared. They never did find them. And the weird thing was is that the man's first name in this case was Graham, which was the last name of the other people that had disappeared. The man, his wife was murdered.
Yeah.
And also, they were both originally from San Diego, and their boats were kind of almost the same name as well. Like the original boat from the Grahams was the Sea Wind, and this family of Graham Hughes was the Sea Dreamer, which was kind of weird. And they never did find out what happened to them either. So
weird.
There's all these little synchronicity, you know, little things that link the cases, and it's just, you know, nobody knows. It's all circumstantial, really, but there's just enough weirdness to kind of link them together in a way that just makes people scratch their head, you know, like, you know, I want to know what went on over there.
Yeah, yeah. Yikes.
It's one of my favorite stories of weird islands out in the middle of nowhere, you know?
Yeah. I'll move into the next story here, because as you said, you kind of started out in the crypto realm, and this was the first story you did for Mysterious Universe. I got a friend who, when he does sort of research on this, he likes to start with the person's first story, as it says a lot about them, and I agree. So tell me about the Jinkin Men.
The Jinmenken. Yes. The Jinmenken. This is one of the weirder stories from Japan, right, for sure.
Yeah, tell me about this creature or whatever it is. I'm not sure. Well, I know what it is, I guess, based on what you've written, but folks don't. So tell us about this odd little creature.
Right, so Jinmenken is basically translated from, basically means in Japanese, the human-faced dog. As far as the stories go, this is a dog. I mean, it looks like a dog in all respects, but it has a human face, which is, it's pretty weird. And it sounds like, you know, purely a folkloric kind of thing, you know, from Japanese folklore. But there have been a lot of stories over the years that kind of point to maybe something more with it. Basically, the Jinmenken, what they call it, is usually about the size of a medium-sized dog. It's got usually pretty dirty looking. And most of the stories go that people see it from a distance and think it's, you know, just a regular dog, and they call out to it. And when it turns around, they see it has a human face. And it'll sometimes talk, apparently.
Oh.
Usually it tells people to go away. It'll just say, leave me alone. And, I mean, these stories go way back. I mean, way back in Japan, these stories of this dog with this human face that'll just turn around, freak people out, and usually tell them to leave them alone. Sometimes they'll have simple conversations with them, but the main story is they tell them to leave them alone. It's really persistent in Japanese folklore. I mean, at least from the 1600s. They've had these, and it sounds like just a weird ghost story. But they were apparently actually sometimes captured, and they would show them at these things called misemono, which is basically these sideshows, like circus sideshows that were really popular back in the, what they call it, the Edo period of Japan, which was from the 1600s to nearly the end of the 1800s. I think it was 1868. And they would catch them and put them in these misemono, which were like circus sideshows. And basically these cabinets of curiosities, they would show things like animals from around the world, mummified remains of things, all kinds of weird stuff from around the world. And sometimes they would have these shows where they would show the Jinmenken. And people would go there and actually see them right in front of their face. It wasn't really... I mean, nowadays people think maybe it was trickery, you know, somebody glued a mask on dogs or something. But there were people who actually went by there, like, who had credentials, like zoologists and things from Europe.
Yeah.
And they would take a look at them, and they wouldn't be able to figure out, like, how, I mean, there were no stitches, there were no anything to show that it was a fake.
Right. There were people who considered that at the time, is what you're saying. Yeah.
At the time, they thought, you know, wow, what is that? You know, and so it had although it sounded like a spooky kind of urban legend, there were things in history with these shows, these Mise Mono sideshows, where people were going there and actually seeing. A lot of people would look at them and think, well, what is that? So that's kind of curious to me. Like, what were they seeing? You know, so that was appealing to me, and I've heard these stories for a while, and I thought, what were they seeing? You know, I can't say for sure. I mean, I'm not saying there are human-faced dogs out there, but it's definitely weird, you know?
Yeah, it's very strange, and the element, you add an extra element to it with the fact that it was in these circuses and stuff. So it's like,
really, they were in these sideshows, and apparently living specimens. I mean, these weren't just dried up, like taxidermed, you know, like a monkey's face glued onto a dog.
Right.
I mean, they were apparently moving around and freaking people out.
Yeah. Are there any accounts of these captured ones talking?
Apparently the ones that were captured would do the same kind of thing as the old stories. They would tell people to leave them alone. Sometimes they would beg for food. You know, apparently they were a lot quieter in captivity, but they would sometimes beg for food or tell people to go away, and they would just kind of mope in the corner. And they apparently talked.
That's so
and,
weird.
People who saw them, like there was this zoologist from Europe who went there, and he wrote about them, and he said, you know, this thing really, really freaked him out. Like, when he went back, he couldn't get his mind off of this thing, and he wanted to go back and study them. And, of course, when he went back, it was gone, as these things happen often go. But it's weird. That's actually a common thing with these things, the Jimenken, is that they instill this sense of fear and dread in people who see them. And that's also kind of a weird, almost paranormal twist to it.
Yeah, yeah. Very strange. And now, how often are they still seen nowadays, or is that sort of like few and far between?
They're seen nowadays, in the modern day. They're not very common, but there was one case, I believe it was in the 80s, Shinjuku, which is actually a major, I mean, this is a major shopping area. I mean, when you think of Blade Runner with the neon lights and the big TVs, this is Shinjuku, and in this back alleyway there were stories for a while of seeing these things, usually in the back of restaurants where they'd be kind of rooting through the garbage, and people would see them, something rooting through the garbage, and they would look and say, oh, what is that dog? It's looking through the garbage. And it would turn around, and sure enough, they would say it had a human face. And this is not out in the middle of nowhere. This is in the middle of this major shopping, downtown district, which is kind of weird. Those are pretty persistent throughout the 80s, actually. People kept saying they saw these things in the back alleyways. I mean, what do you make of that? Is that just stories that people are telling, or what? But, I mean, there were a lot of them in the 80s, and then it kind of dropped off. There were no more real sightings after that, but occasionally people will say that that these things will run out. Like, people will be driving along lonely roads, and these things will run out, and they're pretty known for being fast. And they'll kind of keep up with the car and kind of chase the car for a little while and then disappear. And people still tell stories like that up until now, up until modern days. Shibuya, it wasn't Shinjuku, it was Shibuya, a big shopping area, that's where they were seen in the 80s. That was one of the more famous things. I think it was even in the newspapers at the time. Hmm. People kept seeing these things.
Weird.
And, it sounds kind of absurd. It sounds kind of absurd. So a lot of people in Japan have tried to figure out what they might have been seeing, and the main idea is that it was Japanese macaques, which are basically monkeys, Japanese monkeys, that can be found pretty much all over Japan, And they sometimes venture into urban areas, and they kind of look like, I guess, a dog if you, you know, if you see it from a distance. And it has kind of a human-looking face, so people think that maybe they're seeing those. But, you know, again, a lot of Japanese know what a Japanese macaque looks like.
Right, yeah.
That's not what they're saying. That's not what we saw. No, that's not what we saw. We saw it was a human-faced dog. And, you know, Japanese macaques are the main explanation for them right now.
Yeah.
And they make all kinds of noises that might sound like people talking. So, but, you know, nobody really knows what causes these stories. And they've been going on, yeah, occasionally. You know, reports pop up
weird
to this day. So,
yeah, that's a cryptid I'd never heard of before until I read your stuff.
Yeah, the Jinbenken. It's hard to say with Japanese cryptids sometimes because a lot of real animals in Japan have been kind of imbued with this, with magical powers, and you know, they're superpowers. Like you got crows, you got the badger, you got foxes. All of those have been given all these weird abilities and powers over the years. I mean, if you had just heard about what a fox is from a Japanese person back in the old days, you would think it was just a story, an urban legend, but it's a real animal. So with Japanese cryptids, sometimes you never know if it comes from a real animal or not.
Yeah.
Because a lot of real animals have been kind of given these powers. Yeah, it's with the Jinbenken, you wonder, is it a real animal that just has been played up to be more mysterious, or is it just totally folklore, or what? You know, it's hard to tell sometimes where the line is.
Yeah.
With Japanese cryptids, so that's interesting to me.
Yeah, it's a strange, strange story. And like I said, what piqued my interest was the traveling sort of curiosities thing, where it's like, this is
right
way beyond sort of like a Bigfoot type story, because we're dealing with accounts of stuff being seen by many witnesses and things like that.
Yeah, a lot of witnesses saw them, and nobody could figure out if it was trickery. Nobody could figure out how they did it. I mean, these things moved like real animals. So, you know, I wish I knew what they were seeing. Like, how did they pull it off?
Yeah.
And Japanese craftsmen have been famous for a while for making like really nice taxidermed fake things, like mermaids and things like that. But for something moving and alive, I'm not sure how they would be able to pull that off. But a lot of people saw them.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, kind of in the same vein as the Palmyra Atoll is the Suicide Forest, which is really... I watched a documentary about it on Vice, which
right.
is a half-hour show where they went in with, like, an expert into the Suicide Forest, and it was, like, so chilling and so just unsettling. And they're actually making a movie, I guess, about it here in the States.
It should be made into a movie. It's definitely movie-worthy material.
Yeah. Tell folks at home here about the Mysterious Suicide Forest of Japan.
The Mysterious Suicide Forest is, the real name of it is Aokigahara, which basically means the Sea of Trees. And it's near Mount Fuji. Probably a lot of listeners know where Mount Fuji is. It's an iconic landmark of Japan. And it's at the base of Mount Fuji, and it's just this... I mean, in the daytime, I suppose it's quite beautiful. I mean, it's an old-growth forest, and it's really peaceful and quiet. Very nice scenery. A lot of people go there to hike and to for leisure activities. But there's kind of a dark underbelly of it, and it's known as the Suicide Forest. You can kind of see it if you go there and visit it. There's something kind of weird about it, about that place. It's really quiet. It's quiet. I think it's mostly due to the density of the trees. The trees are really close together. And it kind of blocks out the sunlight. It's dark. It's a spooky place to begin with. Very, very quiet. I mean, there are no birds there or anything. You can't really hear them. Everything's got a kind of a muted quality to it. That's what most people say when they get there. There are other weird things there, like apparently compasses won't work. The needles kind of spin around. They think that's probably magnetic. There's a lot of iron in the soil there, so they think that might be it. Mm. But it's still weird. I mean, that plus the darkness and the, you know, the quiet, it's apparently a really, really kind of almost heavy blanket of quiet over the area.
You can even get that from the Vice thing. Just watching the Vice thing, you get just that sense of how it's it's like out of time almost. It's really weird.
It's almost out of time. You get there and it's this surreal sense. Everything's muted. It almost feels like you're in a dream. I mean, it's just weird. And then people apparently get lost in there, like even experienced hikers who kind of know the way of the land report just kind of like not knowing where they are and kind of like walking around in circles. And it's got this disorienting effect to it. And I'm not sure if that's supernatural or anything, but it has that effect on people. And if you walk around there a little bit, you'll find kind of weird things laying around on the forest floor that nobody ever bothered to really clean up. Like you'll find shoes, like people have just left shoes out in the middle of the forest. And it's kind of weird. Photographs just laying around, strewn about. They found dolls, like freaky little dolls just kind of laying there. They don't know if people just leave those on purpose or if these are the people that commit suicide, but one of the things that's really famous about the Aokigahara Forest is people go there to kill themselves, basically. Nobody really knows why this place is so popular, but people are drawn there, and they go out there, and they hang themselves from trees is usually what they do. Mm. And people have been hiking through the forest, and it's already spooky, like I've been saying. It's spooky enough it is. You see these little dolls laying on the forest floor, and you come across a body hanging from a tree, sometimes totally decomposed. And a lot of them, like, it's got a very high rate of suicides reported in that forest. And nobody seems to know why people want to go there to kill themselves. That plus all of the other weird stuff I've been mentioning kind of makes it a bizarre place to be, I would suppose.
Yeah.
You know, Japanese people who've called it basically has kind of this nickname as the perfect place to die because it's such a peaceful, you know, locale and people want to go there and they kill themselves. And apparently it's got one of the highest suicide rates in the world. From what I know, I heard the Golden Gate Bridge is one of the highest, and Aokigahara is second. It's weird. I mean, this has been happening since the 50s, at least. I mean, people have been coming here. They say there are nearly 100 suicides a year there. That's what authorities say.
Nice.
And, strange. It's kind of a spooky, kind of, you know, the spooky forest where people are just going to die and nobody really knows why, what makes it so popular. And there have been stories over the years, like the forest almost calls them, like some people who have gone there to commit suicide and kind of had second thoughts and went back home have said that they kind of felt like they were drawn there almost, like that was the place to go to die. And they can't quite explain it themselves, but it's almost like the forest was calling to them, which is, you know, kind of sends a chill up the spine.
Yeah. Like I said, that's another place, like, I want to visit, but then I'm sure, not sure if I want to or not. Like, it sounds like, have you, not necessarily the suicide forest, but have you had a chance to sort of visit any strange locations that are sort of tied to these Japanese mysteries or oddities or cryptid type tales?
Yeah, I've been to a few places. I've been to Sunshine 60, which is a building that's supposedly haunted in Ikebukuro, Tokyo. Ikebukuro is an area of Tokyo. And it was built over a prison. It was called Sugamo Prison. Now it's this major shopping center. They call it a city within a city. It's got, it's got shops, It's got office buildings. It's got office space. It's got an aquarium on the 10th floor.
Oh, wow.
Like a full-blown aquarium. I mean, this it's a really sprawling kind of shopping entertainment area, but it was built over this prison that was known for executing war criminals during right after World War II, and is supposedly heavily haunted. I never saw anything weird there, but I've been there a few times. Supposedly all kinds of apparitions that appear there, like there's a lady that jumps off the observation tower, and you'll see this ghostly figure jump off, and you'll go to help them, and there's nobody there. I've been there a couple times, and I've been out to the base of Mount Fuji near Aokigahara Forest, and I never personally saw anything strange there, but I can see where people would be a little freaked out. It's a very weird place. It's got a kind of ominous feel to it, even in the daytime.
Yeah.
I've also been out to some of the areas where they say that some of the other Japanese cryptids, like the Tsuchinoko, which is it's kind of like a cryptid snake. It looks like a fat snake that kind of jumps along. It's another Japanese cryptid. Apparently, a jumping snake. Apparently, it'll sometimes roll along like a wheel, according to the old stories. I've been to some of the areas where those are supposed to be around, looking for them, and I've done some research looking for them, and never saw one. But I've been around a few places in Japan,
nice.
Kind of checking up on these things myself. The Japanese wolf, which is extinct now, people think that it's still out there. I've gone out on some expeditions kind of looking for those as well. Haven't found anything yet, but intriguing stories nevertheless.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, that Suicide Forest, it's, like I said, on the Vice special, I thought it was really, it was just chilling too. They go into the forest with an expert.
People go in there.
There's like a sign that's obviously it's in Japanese, but he reads it, and it's like a plea to whoever's reading it not to kill themselves. It's like life is short.
We have a lot of this.
You know, think of your family, think of your parents, call someone. It's like really freaky,
right.
Like to see that's how serious it is.
Yeah, they have those signs all over the place, and they're usually on these really desolate-looking trails that go out into this dark forest, and you come across the sign that says, "Think about your family. Don't do it. Don't kill yourself." I mean, that's how much of a problem it is. Every year they send out body hunts, basically. The police and volunteers send out hunts to basically go look for the bodies of all of these people that go out there and disappear. It's pretty chilling.
Yeah.
Some of them are never found. Some people go out there and then they just never hear from them again. But they send out these groups of volunteers to go try and find as many as they can, and they say there's up to 100 a year. So I don't know if those signs are working or not. It seems like people are ignoring the signs, but they have them up. They have security cameras. They have police patrols that go through there all the time. But it keeps going on, and it's just this weird, freaky forest. And that forest actually has a long history of folklore behind it. It's long been known for having all kinds of ghosts and demons and Japanese yokai. They call them yokai. They're basically Japanese boogeymen and weird monsters from myth. That forest has had a long history of being considered to be haunted. So that adds to the kind of spookiness of the story.
I can only assume, and I mean this with the utmost respect, but I can only assume that it's almost certainly haunted now. If haunting is possible, it must be haunted.
If it's not haunted, it should be. It seems like a place that should be haunted. Like, if you go there, you think, if this is not haunted, then it should be.
Yeah.
It's got such a long history of these suicides, ghost stories. One of these almost mythical practice from back in the old days is that they had this thing called ubasute, which was they would take their sick or elderly relatives, and they wanted them to die in peace. So they would take them out in the middle of nowhere and just leave them there to die. It was an old, apparently, I mean, It was an old Japanese practice. Some people say that it wasn't a real tradition, but it's been said to have been an old practice. And they leave these people out there just to die in the middle of nowhere. And apparently that suicide forest was pretty famous for that. So even back in the old days, like the 16, 1700s, people were going there to die. So that's another spooky detail of the story.
Very weird.
It really drew me. That place is very weird. I've actually never been in the middle of it or gone really up, but I've been in that area.
Close enough,
and,
right?
yeah. You know, it is. I was I'm not sure if I want to go in there or not. But that forest has got something going on. It's weird. I mean, regardless of whether it's really haunted, regardless of whether there's really ghosts there, the fact is that over 100 people go there to commit suicide every year. So that's weird,
yeah.
No matter how you look at it.
Definitely.
I think so. A very spooky place.
Now,
Okigahara.
We talked about the cursed Palmyra Atoll, and that sort of segued into sort of these strange islands. One of them that you wrote about was the mysterious Ghost Island of Japan, which at first you think that it would be something kind of akin to the Suicide Forest, maybe, where people see a bunch of ghosts, but it's like a completely kind of different thing going on with this island. It's amazing. And folks, there's going to be links to all this stuff at the Banal of America page, so you'll be able, you know, if you hear us reference one of these articles, if you're not patient enough to go look for it yourself, you can click on the link at Banal of America, and we'll have them all in the recap. But, you know, it sounds at first like it's just an island of ghosts, but it's actually like this strange sort of abandoned island that's it's amazingly built up. It's stunning. It looks like a ship almost from a distance. It's crazy.
Right. Hashima Island. They call it Battleship Island, as a matter of fact, just because of what you said. It looks like a battleship, basically. Hashima Island is right off of Nagasaki, which most listeners maybe know is where the atomic bomb was dropped, one of the atomic bombs. Hashima Island, they call it Battleship Island, Gunkanjima, which means Battleship Island. It's an abandoned island. It used to be basically a coal mining operation. For a while, it was owned by the Mitsubishi Corporation. It was coal mining, and it just brought in all these people. At one point, it was the most intensely, per square kilometer, per square meter, the most intensely populated places in the world, actually.
Oh, wow.
This little island in the middle of the, you know, right off the coast of Nagasaki. And basically, people came in and moved in there. They built up every inch of this island. I mean, it's really amazing, actually. This is a tiny little island. It's like a football field. They built up every single inch of this place. It was just bustling with people, all stuffed into this tiny little area. I've never seen anything like it. Have you seen pictures of it?
Yeah, there's great pictures on your article about it. Now,
those pictures, right?
Yeah, why did it get abandoned, and how come no one's gone back just to rebuild on the island? Why is it just left to decay?
Well, what happened was, the Mitsubishi Corporation bought this island. It was at the end of the 1800s, they wanted to mine it for coal. And they found coal there, and at that time, coal was a major fuel source. So coal was a big thing back then. And they kind of took control of it, and basically coal miners and all their families came there, and at first it was very, very popular place. I mean, people wanted to be there, they wanted to make money, they were mining thousands of tons of coal there, and it was just very prosperous. The company built the place up. It had apartment buildings. It had all kinds of entertainment facilities there. They were digging tunnels under the ocean to mine coal, and people were just flocking there, basically. Apartment complexes, everything there. And so at first it was very, very successful operation and very heavily crowded. I mean, every inch of land was used up, and they were building new landfill around the island to accommodate all these people that were coming. And the reason why it kind of saw a decline was that coal went out of fashion. So after World War II, they were looking for new fuel sources, basically, and it started to be not financially viable to keep this operation going. And they closed it down, and people were like, oh, I'm out of a job now, and they just left. I mean, en masse, and they left it in a hurry, apparently, because if you go there, it looks like people just stepped out for a minute. I mean, there are plates set out on tables. I mean, there are TVs, furniture, things like that in the rooms. You walk around there, you almost expect somebody to come home, you know, yeah, and say, oh, hey, I'm home. You know, it's really quite bizarre how fast everybody just jumped ship,
yeah,
on this island. And it used to be one of the most, like I said, it was the most heavily populated place per square mile on Earth, really. And it just suddenly was empty. And everybody just left everything behind. The company who owned the island didn't bother to go in and remove anything because they figured, it's too much trouble, too much expense, just leave it.
Mm.
So everything was just left to the elements. And it's got kind of a dark history to it because during the – this is where the haunted part comes in. During the war, they had a lot of prisoners going there to mine coal. And at that time, you know, safety precautions were not a priority. So there were very few, I mean, it was very dangerous work. They had no safety precautions, no, nothing like that put in place.
Right.
So people were just basically working down in the mines without any kind of help. I mean, quite a few people died there. One of the islands that they used that was next to Hashima was used as a crematorium. And, you know, the prisoners that were there mining coal would see the smoke from the burning bodies on the horizon, which is pretty freaky. People who tried to escape, they couldn't really because there's a lot of – the area is known for its high waves. They built a wall around the island. People who could get over the wall would usually drown. So it was almost like Alcatraz Island. It was like this place in the middle of the ocean that they were being forced into slave labor, basically couldn't escape, like a prison, and a lot of people died there. And I think that also gives it that, plus the fact that it looks like everybody just up and left. Yeah, I think that has given birth to a lot of the ghost stories that go around out there.
Well, it's cool, too. I'm looking at the article here. It says that in 2009, they partially opened the island. So I guess before then, you couldn't even go there. So I guess it's another place that I'd like to check out someday.
Right. For a while, they didn't allow any visitors. It was considered to be dangerous. A lot of the buildings are pretty, you know, deteriorated, and they didn't allow anybody. Now they allow people there, but it's just a few places of the island people are allowed to go.
Yeah.
But yeah, they've opened it to people. You can go in there and take a look. Anybody who's interested. I think it's difficult to get there because a lot of the tour boats encounter bad weather or high waves. But if you can get a tour that goes there and can actually make it to the island, I guess it's worth checking out. It's a very bizarre place. It just looks like people are still living there, even now. Everything's moldy and kind of dusty, but it looks like people still live there. It's very bizarre.
Hmm.
And they say there are ghosts there. People leave graffiti on the wall saying that this place is evil and Hashima is dead. And people see like ghostly shapes up in the windows. And it's I guess that's kind of be expected, stories like that with such a dark history. But it's really one of the freakier places in Japan that I've heard of. I've actually never personally been there, but from what I hear, I know people have actually been there, and they say it's quite a surreal experience to walk around these old rooms that they're abandoned with plates still out and things like that.
Oh, yeah. Sounds otherworldly. Yeah. We'll stay in the realm of Japan, because there's a whole bunch of other stuff we haven't even got to yet that isn't Japanese. But we're kind of on a Japanese roll here, so we'll stay within the land. Because as I said, I've been dying to do an episode on Japanese stories like this, so I'm just like a fat guy at a buffet right now. I'm loving it.
good.
And you said you started kind of in the crypto realm, and I kind of originally, deep as a child, had kind of the first thing I was into was the cryptid realm too, and Bigfoot, of course, being American. And you wrote about the Japanese Bigfoot, the Bigfoot of Japan. For lack of a better term, that's one Bigfoot we haven't talked about on the show before in all these years.
Right. I think it's a Bigfoot that a lot of people don't even know about.
Well, let's tell them about it, dude. That's why I'm so excited to get you on the show. We're learning so much. We're hearing about so much new stuff. Tell us about the Hibigon.
Yes. The Hibigon is a Japanese-owned, homegrown Bigfoot. And, a lot of people probably who are listening know that hairy hominids are reported around the world. A lot of people probably don't think of Japan when they think of Bigfoot. But, yes, Japan has its own Bigfoot called the Hibigon. And the Hibigon, that comes from where it was originally sighted, which is a Mount Hiba. That's down in the south part of Japan. It's probably people maybe know Hiroshima, which is another place where they dropped the bomb, actually. Mm-hmm. That's where it gets its name, the Hibigon. It's a little bit different, actually, than what a lot of people think of when they think of Bigfoot. They think of these huge, almost human-looking hominids. But the Hibigon of Japan is a lot more ape-like. It's a little smaller. It's not 10 feet tall. It's more like 5 or 6 feet tall. And it's said to be more like a gorilla almost, more ape-like, more animalistic. It's not very human-looking, but still weird considering Japan doesn't have any gorillas or great apes.
Yeah.
It has a lot of, some of the other things are similar to the North American Bigfoot, like the smell. They apparently smell really bad. That's one of the ways you know if one's around is that from its stink. Hmm. But I think the most interesting thing about the Japanese Hibigon is that it all came from one flap of sightings that happened actually only in the 70s. Before that, nobody ever really talked about any kind of Japanese Bigfoot. And then in 1970, it was spotted on Mount Hiba in Hiroshima Prefecture, the Hiroshima area of Japan. The first major sighting where everybody says that that's where the Hibigon was first came to prominence was actually a group of elementary school students with their teachers were out in the forest, and suddenly this thing, like a gorilla, it was kind of described as almost like an ape or a gorilla, came just kind of crashing through the brush, almost an intimidation display.
Yeah.
And that sighting kind of, from there it took off. And from there people started seeing this thing all the time, just in Mount Hiba, just in this one area of Japan.
Huh.
After that, in the 70s, it was sighted by lots of different people, like from all walks of life. And it was always described the same way, as kind of like this ape-like creature. And they found trackways. Again, unlike Bigfoot, they weren't very big. They were like 21 centimeters, which is like, what, size 9 or 10. I mean, these are not huge tracks, but still weird, because they would find them out in where there was snow, barefoot tracks. They were finding trackways and taking plaster casts, just like with the Bigfoot.
Yeah.
People started seeing these things all the time in the 70s, and they're all over the newspapers. The media was reporting, oh my God, the Japanese Bigfoot, Hibigon, Hibigon. You know, sometimes these things were seen with, you know, tools. Some people cited them carrying like tools around, almost like a like some kind of primitive caveman or something.
Oh, weird.
They were seen by a lot of people throughout the 70s, and then the sightings just kind of dropped off. Like after the 1980s, people weren't really seeing it anymore. In modern days, there have been a couple sightings, but not really. It was almost totally the 70s, and almost totally within Mount Hiba, which is Hiroshima. Only that one area. So that's kind of a weird aspect of the story. This is not something like Bigfoot in North America, which is seen pretty much everywhere. This was only seen in one area, and only really in the 1970s. And there have been a lot of ideas of why that is. Some people think that if it is a real undiscovered creature, that maybe it was... it was brought down from the mountains because it was injured, or maybe for some reason it kind of was pushed out of its habitat by people moving into the area, and then it kind of went extinct or went back to wherever it came from. But that's always been something that's been weird about the Hibagon, is that it was seen for such a short range of time.
Yeah, it makes me think that it was something that was there, but it's like, it was a, the old idea of like what they say about Bigfoot in England, where it's like, well, it couldn't survive the breeding population and all that. Maybe it is something like that, where it's just, a very small number of things, and they kind of, these were the last of the Hibagon was what people saw or something. I'm not sure, though.
It could have been the last of them. It could have been, at that time, a lot of people were moving away from the area, and they think that maybe, because not so many people were out hunting wild boar and deer and things, there were not as many hunters at the time, that maybe the things thought that they could come down, that they were safer to come down out of their more remote areas. That was one idea. There are other ideas that are less outlandish, like they think that maybe they may have been really large. Again, here was with the same thing with the Jinmenken, the human face dogs. They think that it was maybe a large Japanese macaque, Japanese monkey that was running around scaring people. But that theory I've never really liked, because the people in that area would know what those look like. They wouldn't be saying, oh, it's a big giant gorilla creature they knew it was a Japanese monkey. Other things are that maybe it was some hermit or mountain man living out there that was maybe scaring people a little bit. There have been all kinds of ideas like that, but I've never really found any idea that really matches what people said they were seeing. It's very clear in the reports that it's some kind of gorilla creature. So it may have been an escaped great ape or something like that.
Yeah, that was my second guess, maybe, that it's like an out-of-place animal that escaped somehow from a zoo or from a private collection or something like that, maybe.
Could have been something like that. It could have been a Japanese subspecies of Asiatic bear, which are... They have black bears in Japan, which have kind of a white spot on their chest. They're black, and one of the interesting things about Hibagon reports is that a lot of people report a white spot on dark fur. So some people have seen that detail and said, well, it's obviously a Japanese black bear. They have a white spot on black fur, but at the same time, they don't, it was kind of like in, North American Bigfoot. They think, oh, people are seeing bears. The same kind of thing goes in Japan. People think they might be seeing bears, which I suppose is a possibility, but these people are not, they're seeing something that looks like a gorilla, so...
Right.
It's the same kind of problem they have with, Bigfoot reports being mistaken for bears. That might have something to do with it, perhaps. But it's a very weird story. People don't really see them nowadays, so we don't really know what's going on. But in a lot of areas in Hiroshima, you can still find... like statues of the Hibagon, and they have like Hibagon crossing signs, and they're pretty proud of of that. I mean, this happened in the 70s, but Hibagon is still pretty popular, especially in that area. People know what you're talking about if you say Hibagon. Oh yeah, the Hibagon, They have, all kinds of Hibagon souvenirs you can buy if you go down there. It's pretty interesting how it's still popular even now.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You do cover a lot of the different cryptids here. I'm going to ask you a little bit about the there's a post you have. There's a lot of different beasts profiled here in the strange beast of Japan's far north.
Right.
One I was interested in is the I'm going to really ruin this one, but the Akoro Kamui. There we go.
The Akoro Kamui.
You've got 19 years of practice ahead of me on this one.
You'll get it. The Akoro Kamui, yes. In Hokkaido, right, which is the northern island of Japan.
Yeah, what is this creature all about?
The Akoro Kamui is originally known from the Ainu people of Japan, which is pretty much like in the United States, the Native Americans. These are the indigenous people of Japan. They're called the Ainu. And although they used to live in other areas of Japan, they were kind of pushed up to the north. Now they live mostly in the northern island of Hokkaido. And throughout Ainu folklore, they've had the story of the Akoro Kamui, which is basically a huge, massive, red, almost octopus-like creature. It's usually described as being quite huge. Some reports have it at like 100 feet or more in width, which is massive. It has been reported throughout Ainu history. They used to say that the Ainu would go out on boats, on fishing boats. They traditionally carried sickles, like, for farming with them in their boats. And they say that one of the reasons they had those was to fight off the Akoro Kamui, which was known to attack boats, steal fishermen's catches, basically freak people out.
Jeez, yeah.
Just by coming up to the surface, they would kind of come up to the surface and then just kind of sink back down. They were prominent with the Ainu, and even some European explorers who came there to study the Ainu said that the Ainu would tell them, "Oh, don't go out on the boats now, and the Akoro Kamui is out there." Or the fisherman would come back really scared to death of something, and he would ask, what are you scared of? Oh, the Akoro Kamui, it's out there. Huge octopus creature, basically. I don't know how else to explain
it. Yeah, that's pretty good, yeah.
It's seen as a kind of like a squid or octopus thing. And they're not friendly. He was known to be aggressive and attack boats and just harass fishermen.
Very weird.
Yeah, not something you want to come across. And it's so prominent in the Japanese folklore that people have tried to come up with explanations for what it could possibly be. And one of the main explanations people say is that it could be a giant Pacific octopus, which is basically the largest octopus in the world, which has they have arm spans of like 15, 16 feet. And they, it could be something like that. It's still not 110 feet or 100 feet like some of the reports say, but maybe it was misidentified. People have tried to explain what they might have been seeing. I suppose, the giant octopus theory might be okay, but yeah, maybe it was mixed with a little bit of folklore there.
Yeah, yeah. Now another, I don't know what you'd even call it, another mystery that's attributed to the Ainu people is these entities, for lack of a better term, called the Koropokuru.
Koropokuru.
There you go. I got that one. I was close on that one. So this is really, really interesting. This is sort of like in the Elvish realm, in a sense. So tell me about the Koropokuru and what you know about these.
They're in a way, they're kind of like elves. They were little people, little hominids, I guess you could say. The name, the Koropokuru, is basically the people who live under the burdock leaves. And burdock is a type of plant. It has a leaf about 4 feet across. So there are the people who live under these leaves. So they're really tiny. They were also like the Akaro Kamui. They were mostly told about by the Ainu, the native people of Japan. They were supposed to be about 2 or 3 feet tall. You know, like a toddler, basically. Some of the older stories say that they're only a couple inches tall. So you have a different size range, but most stories say about 2 or 3 feet tall. They were said to live basically in peace with the Ainu people for a while. The Ainu people didn't even think of them as a myth. They thought of them as just like a fact of life. Oh, the Koropokuru, they're over there. Yeah, we trade with them sometimes. And they would trade with them. They had peaceful relations for a while with them. And these things looked kind of like, not really like gorillas or anything, but like rough looking primitive humanoids. They were said to have beards and said to, be kind of, really primitive, rough, like flat noses and prominent eyebrows and, squash noses and, kind of hairy. They were said to have beards and have a lot of body hair, but they weren't really described as like apes or anything. And, just kind of brutish, basically. And they were known to use tools. They used flint and stone knives, scrapers, things like that. And the Ainu kind of just said, yeah, they were just our buddies for a while. And yeah, they lived out in the forests. They kept to themselves. There were some things that were different than the Ainu, like the Koropokuru made pottery. The Ainus didn't. They lived in pit dwellings, which is basically a hole in the ground with like a cover over it. And the Ainu didn't live in those, but the Koropokuru were said to live in pits, basically in the covered holes in the ground. And they were said to be able to talk a little bit. They could talk a little bit with the Ainu. They weren't very good at talking, but they could do it. Yeah, they were shy, didn't really like the Ainu so much. They were shy. They kept their distance, but they would trade with them and they would talk to them at times. And, so far it sounds like, well, sounds pretty normal. Nothing really mysterious, but there's, no record of those things ever really existing. Hmm. We only know about the Ainu. The Ainu swear up and down that, yeah, these things lived out in the forest. So it's been kind of a mystery as to what. Okay, so they're saying there are these little people living out there trading with us. What were these things? Were they like some kind of miniature hominid, or were they, what were they?
Yeah.
So this has been kind of a mystery for a while. And the thing that with the Koropokuru is that they found, in a way, in a sense, they found evidence of things that these things may have really been out there. They found pit dwellings out in the forest, the pits in the ground, which Ainu never used. They found them, and they found examples of really, really old pottery, which Ainu don't make pottery. Even now, they just don't do pottery, and who's making all this pottery?
Yeah.
They found little tools and toys for hands that aren't really humans. They're really unwieldy for a regular-sized hand, and, I mean, people could say that they're children's toys, but, I mean, we're talking about knives and, weapons and stuff that I don't think these would be appropriate children's toys. So that's another weird thing that they've found. There was a dig in Japan called the Omori Shell Mounds, which was an archaeological dig where they found a lot of these old artifacts. And they found things in there that were not really consistent, like the small size tools and the pottery. They weren't really consistent with Ainu. So it's kind of adds to the mystery a little bit, like, okay, well, if Ainu didn't do this, and they say there are these little people living out in the forest, these really kind of primitive looking people, then maybe there's something to the stories.
Did the Ainu ever explain, like, where these people went?
Apparently, they had kind of a falling out, and the old stories say that there was kind of like a war between them. I'm not really sure what caused it, but apparently there was a war, and the Ainu kind of drove them away, and ever since then, they've kind of just dropped off the face of the earth, like nobody knows where they went, and maybe the Ainu killed them off. I mean, if they ever existed, maybe the Ainu killed them off. Maybe they pushed them out into the fringes of the wilderness.
Yeah.
But regardless of what the reason was, they had some kind of falling out, some kind of war, and these things disappeared. And all we have are these kind of scant evidence that people have dug up, kind of suggesting that maybe these stories are true, but, you know, where they went is kind of a mystery.
It's like much like the Bigfoot. There's these stories of little people around everywhere, too, so it's...
Right. The miniature hominids. Lauren Coleman used to call them proto-pygmies, and it's interesting that, you know, Japan is in the Pacific, and a lot of the South Pacific islands, a lot of the Pacific islands have these stories of proto-pygmies, miniature hominids. One of the modern ways of tying it is the hobbits that they found down in, you know, Indonesia, Flores Islands, the hobbits, the real hobbits, Homo floresiensis, and they think that maybe one of the theories is that maybe those things were more widespread than we know. Perhaps they found a way to settle in other islands around the Pacific, and maybe that has something to do with Koropokuru.
Interesting. That's what I was thinking. Yeah, as I was hearing this, like maybe.
That's one of the theories that could have something to do with it, but nobody really knows for sure. That's a theory that I'm quite interested in. Maybe those hobbits were not confined to that one little island as much as we think, and that theory is interesting. The fact that there are a lot of, you know, Pacific islands where they've seen small creatures. So I've always kind of tied that to the story of the Koropokuru. Maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe they made it as far as Japan.
It's entirely possible, yeah. Yeah, you just don't know, especially with the way continents were back in the day. You know, it may have been easier to get around.
Right. They may have been more mobile than we thought. Maybe they could make boats. Maybe they could spread themselves out better than we thought they could. So, yeah.
It's entirely possible. I could definitely see from a modern perspective us not giving them enough credit to be able to do that when they actually probably could, you know.
We've only found their remains on Flores Island, but maybe they got farther than that. So, yeah, that could be connected to this case with the Ainus, but yeah, it's weird that they kind of just disappeared, and we don't really know anything about it. Is it a story? Is it an old myth? Is it real? Is this real race that lived with the Ainu? That's interesting to me.
Me as well, absolutely. Now I think that kind of wraps up, because we want to really sort of do an overall survey of your stuff. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of the non-Japanese stuff now. But what?
Oh, right.
Because I definitely want to have you back on the show. That's a given. So we'll get into more Japanese stuff in the future. But just one more sort of just general thing, because, you know, the program, Been All of America, kind of started out really heavily into UFOs and Bigfoot. And, you know, it's evolved over the years into all kinds of strange and unusual topics. But part of the thing that was sort of gnawing at me when I originally wanted to do a program about Japanese paranormal stuff was the whole UFO mythos. Because I just don't ever hear much about, aside from this famous Japanese airliner case, you really don't hear much about sort of the culture of ufology over in Japan. So I guess what's it like over there? Just, you know, from a from your perspective, as someone who's pretty tuned into the paranormal world, what's your sense of sort of like the state of UFO interest and studies and lore over there in Japan?
UFOlogy is very, very big over in Japan.
Really?
It's very, very popular. There are a lot of TV shows that cover this kind of thing over here. Japanese have a real strong interest in it, actually. There are a lot of hot spots in Japan, actually, for UFOs. Mount Fuji, actually, is one of them. Mount Fuji's been known to be quite the hot spot of UFOs. All kinds of UFO sightings out there. Usually, when they have a major earthquake over here, or they have a major volcanic eruption, which happens a lot in Japan, because there are a lot of volcanic islands, those are usually almost always followed by a flap of UFO sightings.
Yeah.
That's covered quite a lot in the news.
Huh.
It's big over here.
General Nakatani was testifying to the Japanese parliament when somebody asked him, Antonio Inoki, a rather colorful figure in the parliament, asked him, what does he feel about UFOs? What does he know about UFOs? What can he tell us about the existence of UFOs, aliens, and whatnot?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
And General Nakatani said this, when the Air Self-Defense Force detects indications of an unidentified flying object that could violate our country's airspace, it scrambles fighter jets if necessary and makes visual observation. They sometimes find birds or flying objects other than aircraft, but I don't know of a case of finding an unidentified flying object believed to have come from anywhere other than Earth.